Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm Richard Serrett. Join me on Strange Planet for in-depth conversations with the world's top paranormal investigators, alien abductees, Bigfoot trackers, monster hunters, time travelers, alternative archaeologists, remote viewers, and more.
As I was on the way to Area 51, I was stopping on the side of the road and just taking measurements, and I found this one spot where time slowed down by a fraction of a second. It's not supposed to do that.
From the two big categories, animal mutilations and human abductions, you have to conclude that genetic material is being harvested.
Well, I reached for a rifle, and I turned and looked, and it was already moving away, and it was descending the bluff. There's no way any human could have went down it. It was probably a 75-degree angle straight down, almost.
On Richard Serrett's Strange Planet, we're redefining reality. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Do not go any further. Turn around, go home.
There was so much money, he had to hide it in PVC pipes and bury it in the woods. That's kind of been the joke among a lot of my interviews, is, you know, because Freddie forgot where he put it.
Today, I speak to Ed Hudson, who worked as the narcotics and law enforcement officer in the Florida unit responsible for bringing down Freddie Crow. Freddie used to steal planes and fly under the radar with death-defying stunts to reach Belize, where he'd smuggle so much marijuana onto the plane that the pressure would bust open the doors. He wore camouflage and painted his face and became known by the FBI only as Rambo before they could identify him and his partner in crime, Billy. His life was very much like that of Tom Cruise's character in American Made, but it took a drastic change after he was caught and met today's guest, Ed Hudson. After serving time, an unlikely friendship developed between the two before things took a tragic turn. I'll leave that there for now. I came across Ed's fantastic book about the subject, As the Crow Flies, which you can find on Amazon and in selected stores. Look up his Facebook page, Ed Hudson Author, for photos of him and Freddie and Freddie's family. There'll be a link to that on my andrewgoldpodcast.com blog, where I've been updating for every episode and including video trailers and, you know, behind the scenes information. A couple things to note. One, a huge part of the story is, to Ed, religious. Now, I'm not a religious person. In fact, I'd describe myself as a proud and open atheist. But it's impossible not to make a link between Freddie's redemption and punishment tale and religious stories, which to me are just that, stories. But to Ed, there's something more, and it means he speaks with a genuine enthusiasm and passion that elevates the story, both in this interview and in his book. The second point I wanted to make is that Ed has a quite marvelous way of talking. It's a real traditional Deep South accent that we in the UK can only dream of encountering in real life. So if nothing else, I hope you enjoy listening to the musicality of his voice. As regular listeners will know, I always attempt an impression of the many different accents on this show, so it didn't escape my notice, of course, that he says things like, "Well, that's done been done," and "If I need to slow down any," and "We talk how God talks." Anyway, I hope he's not too offended by that. So far, nobody's actually been offended by my impressions of them, so hopefully that will continue. But without further ado, here is Ed Hudson.
Well, hey there.
How are you doing?
I'm good. Good. How are you?
I am good, thank you. That's a hell of an accent you've got.
Well, I was going to tell you, if I need to slow down any, just let me know.
I've seen enough movies of people from your part of the world.
Yes, yes. But you do realize that, you know, we talk the way God talks.
Oh. Does God have a Florida accent?
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's kind of a mixture of Alabama, Florida, and Georgia, I think. It's We're in the panhandle of Florida, and we have influence from everybody.
Yeah. I mean, at the moment, the thing that everybody thinks about maybe from your part of the world is the Tiger King. Did you see any of that?
A little bit. Not a whole lot, but I did watch some of it. Yeah. Yeah. That's not the way we want to be known, though, I don't think.
I can imagine. Oh, my word. He's quite a character, that guy. He's not from where near you, is he?
No. He was from down around Orlando.
Okay. And whereabouts are you?
I am just north of Pensacola. I'm in the extreme northwest corner of Florida.
Okay, gotcha. Tell me a little bit about your position, like what it was, you know, in the narcotics unit. Did you always want to go into that? Is it a little bit, I don't know if you've seen that film Training Day. That's the narcotics team. It was Denzel Washington. You know, it doesn't matter if you've seen it. But what led you to that?
Actually, when I first got into law enforcement, my big desire was to just work patrol in the north end of the county where I live. That was what I wanted to do. I worked there for about 9 years and I began to realize that there was more to the job than just doing that. So, in order to move forward, I needed to get more experience. So I transferred to the narcotics unit down in Pensacola, and it was, That really and truly is the best place to get the most experience in the shortest amount of time, because you're constantly doing search warrants. I mean, when I went into the unit, they were going up on a wiretap and we were listening to telephones and stuff. And that was kind of like going from Mayberry to James Bond. I worked there for 3 years, and my end goal was to get to an even larger organization, which I chose the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. And that's where I wound up working.
Oh, so what kind of thing were you looking at on a day-to-day basis? What kind of like narcotics, drugs, like what kind of situations are you getting yourself into, and how are you stopping people?
Well, you know, during that time, it was crack cocaine was like, you know, the scourge of the street. So in our area, we didn't have much of a heroin problem. The crack cocaine was the big thing. And quite frankly, we looked for marijuana cases just to get some relief from working crack cocaine cases, because the marijuana cases were just more fun.
Why are they more fun?
It was more like a cat and mouse game than the crack. I mean, the crack was just so abundant just out on the street and everywhere. But the marijuana was more like a cat and mouse game. And as I talk about in the book, it was a thrill for them to be able to get away with it. And it was a thrill for us to be able to try to stop them.
Tell me quickly, this is going to sound stupid, but just for the audience, and my audience is very stupid. What is crack cocaine like compared to normal cocaine? What is it, or is it the same thing? What's the difference between crack cocaine and cocaine?
It's a more condensed product of cocaine. It's more pure, and it's generally smoked and inhaled into the lungs, and it's an immediate result from the intake, and it's also much more addictive.
Okay. Do you guys in narcotics, when you're working in narcotics, do you have to have some sort of taste of it, or to be able to understand what it, to be able to recognize it, for example?
Taste as in ingest or?
How do you get familiar to be able to recognize it?
I guess just from seeing it was the main thing. I mean, it's...
They never sit you down and say, like, you've got to try this so you know what it is. And
that's not on purpose anyway.
Yeah. Oh, this is a very movie. It's a movie trope, I think. It happens in.
They used to dip their finger in the cocaine and taste it. No, that doesn't happen. No.
Okay, makes sense. Tell me a little bit about Freddy Crow.
Well, Freddy was, he grew up in the town of Century, Florida, which is in the very, very, it's right on the Alabama Florida state line, and a very small town. About 3 miles long and a mile wide, and That's where he grew up, and that's where he stayed. That was home to him. The book begins with him as a rambunctious little kid that I kind of likened to Dennis DeMenis of Century Florida, because he was always into things, from what they told me. He developed an interest in airplanes very early on. He was just a small child putting airplane models together, and that interest continued to grow and grow. And by the time he was a teenager, he had his pilot's license, and started at a very young age crop dusting. Also, when he became a teenager, he also learned that he liked marijuana. And from that, he began to think that, you know, that'd be a good way to make money. So he kind of parlayed all that into a drug smuggling career.
Wow. How does someone, was he from an impoverished background, would you say? I'm just wondering how somebody learns to pilot a plane, and where somebody gets hold of a plane. I don't know where you buy a, maybe where you're from, there's more sort of planes around. Where'd you get a plane?
Well, I can tell you the area he grew up in was a very poor area. And that's a huge problem in that area. However, his dad owned a bar. And a couple of bars, and as far as being well off, he was probably pretty well off for living in that area. He didn't have to drug smuggle for money; he did it for the excitement.
Okay, so he would have just gotten hold of planes, I suppose, for crop dusting, and that's how he learns. Maybe his parent taught him or something.
Well, he started off his drug smuggling in vehicles, in cars, but his dad actually bought him a small airplane. I don't know what they what they went for back then, but he had a small airplane to fly around in and develop his skills, and he was quite skillful. I started to work there at the Century Police Department. That was my first job. It was a little 5-man department, and I stayed there for a year, and I'd never heard of Freddie Crowe up until I started to work there, and because he was about 10 years older than me. But it didn't take long to hear about him. It wasn't just the drug smuggling part that I heard about. Most of the stories were stories about his stunts on the airplane and things that he did flying the airplane.
What kind of thing would he do? What kind of crazy stunts?
There's a bridge that connects the two counties. And I was told that he flew under the bridge, and I was thinking, man, that guy's crazy if he did that. Well, one of the first things I asked him whenever I sat down to interview him, I just had to get that out of the way. It had been years since I'd heard that story. But I asked him, I said, Freddie, did you actually fly under the bridge, the Highway 4 bridge? And he said, no. I measured it, and there wasn't enough room.
I love the idea of him measuring it, getting out and actually measuring it.
Yeah, but then he said, but let me tell you what it did do. And he started telling me about some of the, he would take his friends up in the airplane and take them on the ride of their life, the only ride of their life, because they wouldn't ever get in a plane with him again after that. But there's a pipeline that crosses the Escambia River Bridge, and it made a big loop over the bridge. And there were some, he had a guy in one of his friends flying in the plane with him, and there were some workers doing repair work on the pipeline, painting it. And he flew under that pipeline while they were on the pipeline painting it. And he said when he looked back behind him, there was paintbrushes went one way and paint cans went the other way. And he kind of got in a little bit of trouble with FAA over that one.
Oh, my word. So Freddie started smuggling drugs. So with the plane, and he was going into Belize. Is that right?
Yeah. After he got caught with smuggling it in the car, he got out of prison and decided to change his way of doing things. So he started using the airplane. He eventually wound up back in prison again, but he came across a guy named Billy Deakle when he went to the prison that time. And they became good friends. Billy was a pilot too, and he was a drug smuggler as well. There's several good characters in this book, and Billy is one of them. Billy is, a guy that that came from a law enforcement family. His grandfather was his great grandfather was a judge. His grandfather was a sheriff. His father was a major in the Florida Department of Corrections. His sister worked for the Florida Department of Corrections. Everybody was in law enforcement except for Billy, and he was busy running from them. So
the black sheep.
Yes. Well, I guess you could say that. But he came across Billy, and Billy had a connection to Belize. So they both got out close to the same time. Billy got out first, but they hooked up when Freddie got out. And they began flying down to Belize. They would take turns flying, and sometimes they would fly a plane that required to have a pilot and a co-pilot. And then they would both fly down together. And you have to get a sense for this, too, now, because they're flying into another country, landing in the jungle, more or less, in a makeshift airstrip, getting enough marijuana that people would kill you for. And then they fly back, and they would sort of follow the coastline until they reached a certain point around the Yucatan Peninsula, and they would shoot over out into the Gulf. And to get back into the country, it would require them to get down about 200 miles out. They would have to get down so low over the Gulf of Mexico that they'd be flying just mere feet over the waves.
And why is that? So they're not caught on the radar, is that right?
That they had to get under the radar coverage, and that's what it was called, is flying under the radar.
Yeah, I noticed that in your book. I hadn't ever realized why we say, oh, it's under the radar, and is that where that expression comes from?
That is it. That is it. Getting under the radar to where it can't detect you. And they would do that. They would fly so low, salt would collect on their windshield, and they continue on until they get to the coast. And then once they hit land, they just shoot up like, you know, normal airspace and fly like any other airplane, and it's no problem.
Why can't a radar pick up on people who are quite low down? Is that too technical to, well, maybe I won't even understand the reason.
You have to think about the curvature of the Earth, and the radar kind of just sort of shoots over an area after so far. You know, it's okay. like hitting a valley. That's my best explanation. But
that's quite a good explanation, actually. It's simple enough for me to understand it. So,
but they were doing this in airplanes that sometimes they bought them, sometimes they stole them, and sometimes they crashed them. And I guess all that added to the excitement as well.
Would you say? Can I just ask? I mean, so he went into prison for sort of maybe minor misdemeanors to an extent. And then he came out. I mean, prison's supposed to rehabilitate you. And he sort of came out of it going and stealing planes and crashing them, and it's sort of the next level. Would you say it's sort of prison went not the way it's supposed to do for him?
Well, yeah, there's a couple of things wrong there. To begin with, they weren't misdemeanors because, I mean, his first arrest was he had 250 pounds of pot in the trunk of a car. And so that's kind of felony level there. One of the things about prison is it doesn't really rehabilitate you. But then again, unless you want to be rehabilitated, it's not going to happen anyway. But the other thing is that it's a fantastic network for people that are in that kind of business. You know, they get to know one another and meet more people I don't really know what the answer is for that.
No, it's complicated, isn't it? Because obviously they have to go to prison. I don't know what the other option is. It's just unfortunate that they end up meeting people who will just, as you say, it's like a networking event for them.
Yeah. And he was offered, you know, like drug rehab whenever he'd go in. And of course, everybody takes it because they want to be seen as the model inmate.
Yeah.
You know, the whole time he's thinking, you know, he can't wait to get out to pursue the adrenaline rush.
Are they getting access to drugs on the inside, do you think?
You know, he never talked about that I know of. I don't remember hearing him say that, but I know that drugs are available inside prison. So that's another problem as well. There's several things to address. And, you know, at some point in time, we have to take a look at just what exactly it is we want to get out of prisons and then put the resources in there to do it. And I'm not sure that they have the resources.
I've heard you talk about how people often compare his antics to the movie American Made with Tom Cruise in it. And that was his life for a while, just crashing planes, stealing planes and smuggling drugs and stuff. I mean,
I think and if the story ended there, you know, and I've had people, when I'd start telling them about the book, I've had people tell me, well, that's done been done. I said, now, wait a minute, you got to hold on. But another thing about Freddie, when he gets out this last time, he tells Billy, he said, Billy, I don't want to meet anybody. I don't want them to know who I am, and I don't need to know who they are. So in order to do that, Freddie used to put camouflage on his face and wear fatigues. And he would do that to try to hide his identity. And he never told any of them who he was. Billy knew, of course, but the rest of them in the group did not know. So they had to give him a name. So they nicknamed him Rambo. And that's how they knew him, was Rambo. And the funny thing about it is that as people began to get knocked off in the organization, they began to talk somewhat. And they began to tell the story about how Billy Deacle was involved in this. And there was this other guy that they don't know who he is, but they call him Rambo. And so the federal government indicted Rambo. Rambo and Billy were indicted for like 3 years before they were caught.
So the government didn't know who he was, and they said, we are indicting Rambo.
They're indicting this character named Rambo. That's the name that they had. So now, as the investigation went on, they began to suspect strongly that Freddie Crow was Rambo, but they couldn't prove it. But then Billy gets arrested, and it's in his trial. They begin to bring other witnesses back in, and during that trial, they were able to definitively say that Rambo is Freddie Crow, and Freddie gets arrested while Billy is in trial.
Right. Did Billy, I don't know, what's the formal way of saying rat him out? I can't think of a more neutral way. Denounce him.
No, Billy did not. No, Billy did not cooperate at all. He took it on the chin. Now, Freddie, on the other hand, when he gets arrested, he gets thrown into the jail. There's also another character in the book that just really shines. Freddie has an older sister named Bobby. Bobby helped raise Freddie, and she helped raise him right. She tried her best to make sure that he had a good firm foundation when he was growing up, and then she took him to church regularly and made sure that he at least had the knowledge. And I think all of that came back to Freddie. When he's sitting in that jail cell, it begins to dawn on him that he's made some bad decisions. And he realizes that there are consequences for those decisions, because he's looking at a life sentence with his record and the amount of drugs that they could put on the organization and all. Freddie makes the decision to cooperate. He decides that he needs to burn his bridges with the smuggling world and openly cooperate with the government.
But is that because he was brought up well, as you say, by his sister, or was that because he was scared of being put in prison for the rest of his life?
I think he was scared for getting put in prison for the rest of his life, and he realized that what his sister had taught him was the way out. Mm. I believe that's the way it went.
That's a kind way of looking at it. Some might say he just wanted to save his own derriere.
Well, yes, that's been done. Let me tell you, that has been done before. But then you have to take a look at the changed life after that.
Okay.
And I think you see that he was sincere. He made it a point to develop new friendships and put the old ones away. I mean, this book is a lot about friendships. He had the friends as he grew up as a child, and they separated and went their different ways because they didn't agree with what he was doing. And he develops new friendships like Billy. But then he has the friendship of his sister who was with him from birth, yeah. and all through all the bad, and even though she didn't agree with anything that he was doing, she just wouldn't give up on him. Then there's the friendship that he developed with a lady named Sandra that ultimately became the one and only Mrs. Freddie Crow.
Right. Yes, that's right. Just to go back a minute, though, he never actually got caught, you know, while flying, while smuggling or anything like that, did he?
He got caught with the 250 pounds in the car.
Yes, yeah.
He got caught with that. But with flying, he never actually, no, he did not.
Sounds like quite a good system, isn't it? I mean,
They were quite successful. They were. They were flying, you know, usually like every other month and bringing in anywhere from 650 to 1,000 pounds of load. They flew enough that they made enough money that money became a problem. They couldn't use banks.
That's filling up the plane, is it? Is that sort of filling up? I remember reading at one point about how, like, if you get too greedy, it will sort of sink the plane.
Well, he told me that he had a problem with getting greedy because he just kept telling them to put more in. Then when he went to take off, there'd be so much weight on it that the pressure from the plane popped the doors open. So, and you don't want to be flying, flying around with your doors popped open. So they'd have to take some out. But there was so much money, he had to hide it in PVC pipes and bury it in the woods. That's kind of been the joke among a lot of my interviews is, you know, because Freddie forgot where he put it. Not only did he forget, when he went off to prison, he wound up with a 10-year sentence as opposed to a life sentence. So he went away for 10 years. And during that 10 years, we got hit with two hurricanes in the area. And they were bad hurricanes, and they changed the terrain tremendously. And when he gets out, he can't find his money. That was kind of a running joke around here about, go and get Freddie and go look for some PVC pipe.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to be buried in an avalanche?
Weird foreign feeling of despair.
Or how it feels to crash a skydive?
I remember hearing a thud, feeling my body hit the ground.
Or how you would react if you were being attacked by an alligator?
At the end of my leg is this huge alligator head on my leg.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a victim of an attack.
Dragging me into the bathroom and saying, I'm going to kill you. Now you're going to die.
You'll hear from a man who discovered a baby.
How could this be? How could there be a baby on the ground?
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Clinky County 911.
There's a man at my back door. He's trying to get in.
What Was That Like is a podcast about real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app or at whatwasthatlike.com.
Wait, what's PVC pipe?
That's a plastic pipe. It's used for like water lines, or sewer lines. He would get the, like 8 inches across pipes and fill them full of money and then cap them off so they're watertight and bury them.
Right. So that they're probably out there then, tens of thousands.
Yeah. 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 I kind of expected a gold rush to hit Century when this book came out. You know, everybody get their picks and shovels and hit the woods. But
yeah, I'm in Berlin right now. I'm just going to look up if they've got any direct flights to Florida. Yeah. I'll be out there in a minute with I guess not a metal detector, a plastic pipe detector or whatever.
Well, that's the problem. There's no way to really detect it. I guess you could get ground penetrating radar maybe and find it if you knew where to start.
So why can't you, I suppose because it's not safe, but you can't just take it back to your house because somebody might come and investigate and somebody might rob you. Is that right?
Well, he did keep some in between the mattresses and quite a bit, but he had more than that, you know. So, you know, when you're into business, you never know when the police are going to come knocking, and you don't want them to, you know, you keep everything else hid, and you don't want to have a load of money like that you can't account for. So
how much do you think he was making? You said he was going every other month. Like, how much do you think he was making each time?
You know, I'm not sure. A lot of it depended on the size of the load and all, but
are we talking tens of thousands?
Oh yeah. It may have been up to 100,000 or so, or more.
That's what would it have been? I guess a day's work.
Right, a day. That's, you know, just flying down there because he had his people who distributed it once he got back. He didn't get out on the street and sell it. He had certain people that took care of selling the marijuana. So, you know, all his job was done in a day.
It's not a bad way of making money. I might have to look in a career change because, you know, doing this podcast, I'll have to work for about 20 years to earn what you did in a day.
Well, but then again, can you do the time?
I couldn't last a minute.
I don't think I'd want. But you know, we were talking about, you know, whether or not Freddie did it for the right reasons or not, when he talked about, I have to tell you that I saw such a change in him. I can tell you when he got out, one of the things that he did was after he got sent off to prison, I left the sheriff's office and went to work at Florida Department of Law Enforcement. And my very first case was Freddie's cocaine supplier, the person that he got his cocaine from. So I knew this from the interview that I did with Freddie. So I called him back out of prison and he testified against his cocaine supplier. And when I took him back, that's when I took him back to prison and we had a real nice conversation about him changing his life and all. And matter of fact, I told him I said, Freddie, it ain't like you got a lot to do right now. Why don't you write a book? But whenever he went to get out of the car, he asked me, he said, do you mind if I call you? And I said, sure. I mean, thinking like a cop, you know, here I get somebody inside the prison that might can give me some information and all. So I said, sure. Give me a call.
Is that how you started to become friendly?
That is how he kind of started, because he did call me. He called me every now and then. The phone would ring and he'd just be calling and just said, I'm just calling to check in and see how things are going. So then after it got time for him to get out, the last call he made to me, he said, would it be okay if I came to see you? Well, you know, at this point in time, I'm still thinking, I guess it'd be all right. I just couldn't be, but just a little bit of doubt in my mind about why would you come see me? But I told him, come on, it'd be all right. So he did, but he didn't just go see me. He went to see the prosecutor. He went to see the other agents, the agents involved in the case. And there was a common theme behind all those visits, and he was more or less just apologizing and wanted everybody to know that he was through with what he had been doing. And it wasn't just us. He apologized to his family. He had a lot of fences to mend there, and he went to work trying to mend those fences. And even people that he didn't even know, Freddie was a very easy person to talk to, and he would start talking to them, and before they got too far in the conversation, he would stop and he would tell them what he had done, because he wanted them to know who they were talking to and what he had done. And if they had decided that they didn't want to associate with him, he wanted them to make that decision right then.
Yeah, that's quite a, it's a common literature trope. That's from the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, the albatross and everything. The curse of the albatross is that you have to go around telling everybody you meet the crime that you did in order to earn some form of redemption that would never fully come. And I suppose Freddie's story is quite literary in that sense, because he doesn't fully get his redemption. Well, I suppose he does, but he's sort of punished in a way, isn't he, by what happened next?
Well, he is somewhat, but I also want to say that he didn't stop with asking forgiveness with just us. He sought his forgiveness from God as well.
Yeah.
Because he knew that was something he needed to do. He winds up marrying Sandra and everything's going good. He's got a business going and life is good. And he develops a pain in his side and he goes to the doctor and that's when he learns he has terminal cancer. And that was a tough phone call. He called me not long after he found out and just wanted me to know. And I think that's when our relationship really changed. You know, he had even been an informant for me when I was at FDL after he got out of prison. And it wasn't for proactive cases because he had burned that bridge and I didn't really want to see him trying to build it back for any reason. His information was just valuable to a lot of agencies. They just wanted the opportunity to sit down and learn what Freddie Crowe knew. And he came in and I sat in on all the interviews. And matter of fact, after one of them, I told him, I said, Freddie, you know what we need to do? He said, what's that? I said, I think we need to put you on the stage and sell tickets, because he was very entertaining. A very entertaining person to talk to. But then he called me and tells me that he's got terminal cancer. And that's when the Christian inside of me sort of kicked in. I felt compelled to walk with him during whatever days he had left. We became real good friends. As time went on, he needed some help getting to and from the doctor because Sandra had to go to work and I would help out with that. And I would go over to his house and sort of do the things that he was no longer able to do. And he was seeing things that needed to be done because he knew that he wasn't going to be around.
How were you feeling? Was it losing a friend?
Yeah, in the end, it was very much like that. It really was. Because I'd gotten used to him. Freddie grew a garden up until the last few months that he was alive, and he would fight through the pain to just raise a garden because he liked sharing what he grew. And he would, whatever he had I didn't have, he would give to me, and I would do the same to him. There were certain things that I had that there's a southern grape called Scuppernons, Muscadine, that,
right.
I have vines, and he loved those things, and and I'd give them to him. And, but it was very much like losing a friend, and it was hard to watch him deteriorate, seeing him in pain. And the last day that he was home, he had gotten to the point that Sandra could no longer take care of him. And so they had made the decision that he would go to the hospice house for his last days. And I went over there to sit with him while they were waiting for him to get there. And when I walked in the room, I really didn't know what to say. I still don't know what to say. There's there's just times where words just aren't enough. So I asked Freddie, I said, would you like to pray? And he said, I sure would. And that's what we did. Mm. We prayed. So there for a while, it was just the three of us, just me, Freddie, and God. And it was a prayer of thankfulness. It just thankful for Jesus, what he did on the cross, and thankful for putting us together, me and Freddie, and just thankful to have someone to go to at times like this when words aren't enough. So it was a good prayer. And when I looked up after it was over with, he had tears running down his cheeks, and he took his right fist and beat his chest and said, I can feel God in me. And, you know, it was a terribly sad moment, but it's now the moment that I look back on whenever I get sad, because there's just so much comfort in hearing him say that. And I guess that's one of the things I'd like for people to get out of the book is that there is comfort there if you ask for it.
Yeah. Because it's very frustrating, his life in a way, because he was finally on the straight and narrow and then it was all taken away from him. How do you see that as part of the narrative? I mean, I'm not a religious person myself, but...
Here's how I see it. I believe that we are put here on this earth to serve God. That's our purpose. That's the way I see it. And there are times, there have been cases where a person serves God greater in their death than they can in their life. And I think this is the case.
It was a pleasure speaking to Ed Hudson there. Doesn't he speak beautifully about a very touching topic? It's a fantastic story, and I'll just remind you, you can find As the Crow Flies on Amazon and see photos of Freddie Crow and Ed Hudson on Ed Hudson Author on Facebook. I'll stick a blog up on my andrewgoldpodcast.com as well. Again, I don't share Ed's religious belief, but that doesn't mean I can't find his view of things quite poignant. I didn't know Freddie, so I can't judge. I suppose I'm quite cynical because I think it's easier to repent once you've been caught. But Ed believes that Freddie saw the error of his ways and chose the righteous path. In any case, it is a story of redemption, and I think even us non-religious folk can enjoy a story like that. It's why The Shawshank Redemption is so many people's favorite film. Redemption seems to just be ingrained in us as an integral facet of entertainment or human story. Anyway, that's enough of that analysis. Buy the book, go to his Facebook, find the video trailers for these episodes on Twitter and Instagram on AndrewGold_OK. I've had quite a few new followers of late, and I love interacting with you all. And make sure you're subscribed to this podcast. Leave a review on Apple if you can find a place to do it. It's incredibly complicated for some reason. Last week's episode with Rebecca Sharrock, who is autistic and has a condition called HSAM, which means she is able to remember every moment of her life back to the womb. That story seems to have touched a lot of people. One woman commented on Instagram, I won't say her name because I've not had time to ask permission, to say, loved this episode. She reminds me of my son. He is autistic and has incredible ability with memory. I just went and told him about Rebecca Sharrock, and before I finished talking, he said, oh, she's like me. So I asked what he could remember, and he was like, lots of things, being in the hospital. Which time? I asked. He said, when I was born. And then he got all emotional, which is what he does when he remembers things, good or bad. I never push him further when this happens, as I don't like upsetting him. I've never heard of anyone else that recalls life events like, and it's been so interesting to listen to an older person that has similar experiences. Thank you to you and Rebecca for this. It really means a lot. I love getting comments like that. I don't earn any money from the podcast at the time of talking, so these are the things that keep me doing it into the early hours. If you haven't yet caught that episode, please do. It's just the one before this one, and it's absolutely fascinating. I tested her memory by getting her to finish random sentences I called out from Harry Potter, and she was able to do it flawlessly. Otherwise, Adam Atticus commented on Apple Podcasts alongside a 5-star review. Fascinating topics and guests, very well executed. Thanks, Adam. That's not the first time you reviewed with that name. So who are you, Adam? I want to know who you are. Get in touch. Another was Bored Med Student, who said, took my virginity. So this is the first podcast I've ever listened to and found it to be fascinating and witty while exploring some rather dark issues. Well worth a listen. Well, I can't argue with that. Thanks, Bored Med Student, and hope you're not too bored while you're operating on people and stuff. Next week is Lloyd Evans, an ex-Jehovah's Witness who has a thriving YouTube channel and a lot to talk about regarding religion. I've always found the Jehovah's Witnesses fascinating and don't know all that much about them outside the book White Teeth, which is one of my favorites, by Zadie Smith. So if you want to do some homework, read up on that. That's one of my favorite books, and everyone loves that book, White Teeth, Zadie Smith. I'm really looking forward to talking to him and getting that one out there, and I'll see you guys then. See you next week.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.